Welcome to StrangeNotions.com, where today I'm talking with Trent Horn. Trent acquired his master's degree in theology from the Franciscan University of Steubenville, and he now works as a staff apologist for Catholic Answers, which is the world's largest English-speaking Catholic evangelization and apologetics ministry. Trent travels around the country speaking on pro-life issues, as well as issues about atheism and how to make the case for God with logic and common sense. He has just released a new book called Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity, and it's a tour de force. Trent tracks many of the most common arguments for atheism before constructing a positive case for God's existence. It's a very well-researched book with over 70 pages of endnotes and several helpful appendices. And Trent strikes the right balance between sophisticated philosophy and easy-to-understand examples. He sprinkles the book with many memorable and clear illustrations, along with some fictional dialogues between Catholics and atheists that represent both positions pretty well. Today we're going to be talking a little bit about Trent's new book and some of the major arguments that he discusses. But before we begin, Trent, I want to welcome you. We've all have appreciated your articles and your interactions here at Strange Notions. And so I think I speak for both atheists and Catholics when I say thank you and welcome.
Well, it's good to be here. And I've really appreciated the opportunity to put articles on Strange Notions, and it's been a joy to see the different interactions people have had with them. So I think it's a very great project, and I hope it continues.
Now let's begin looking at a bigger picture here. Over the last decade, we've seen several books come onto the scene written by both well-known atheists and Catholics responding to the so-called new atheism. And so where does your book fit in, and what sets it apart from books by people like William Lane Craig or Dr. Edward Faser?
Sure, great question. Obviously, when someone chooses to write a book, they want to make sure that they're not just throwing a penny on top of an already large pile. They don't, you know, you don't want to reinvent the wheel. The reason I wrote the book Answering Atheism was when I would go and speak on atheism, I felt there wasn't a single book I could recommend to the people that attended my talks on the subject. And I always had to have a kind of trade-off. On the one hand, would be very easy to read books on atheism that were kind of breezy, written from a theistic, Catholic or Christian perspective. And they were short, easy reads. But there were some things that I wasn't a fan of in those books. I felt they didn't really treat arguments very rigorously. Or even worse, their tone was just very, very sarcastic or just mean-spirited towards atheists. I almost felt like sometimes the writers of these books had never actually talked to an atheist in real life. And so I didn't want to recommend these books because I didn't want them to fall into the hands of my secular friends, for example. But on the other hand, there were other books that I really enjoyed that were very academic, addressed the arguments well in thorough detail, but at the same time, I didn't want to recommend them to lay people because they wouldn't get through them, especially without a solid background in philosophy and science. So in my book, I've really tried to strike a balance that the book, its audience are Catholics and Christians to help them engage and answer the arguments for atheism. But I really tried to write the book in a way that if they have an atheist friend that picks it up and reads it, they'll probably disagree, but at least I don't think they'll feel unduly attacked. Or I've tried to understand their viewpoint and try to anticipate their objections to my arguments. And then in my endnotes and appendices, I go into more technical detail. Another thing I think that differentiates my book from others that are on this subject is I've tried to strike a good balance in the book's scope. For example, you could be very, very narrow. There's some books that are written on just one argument for the existence of God, like the argument from reason or the Kalam argument. But it's such a narrow book, it's really technical and hard for people to read. On the other hand, a lot of Christians and Catholic apologists, sometimes when they write a book on atheism, they want to go beyond the touchdown. They also want to make a case for Christian theism or why you should be Catholic and put it all into one book. But I felt that I couldn't really give all those arguments justice. That's why my book, Answering Atheism, I just try to show that atheism is false or not true. I don't even make a full case for Christian theism. I'm actually saving that for a later book. I see this as a foundation for where a Christian or a Catholic would argue from.
Now, before you even dive into the arguments for or against God, you spend several pages examining some of the bad attitudes that plague both Catholics and atheists when discussing these sorts of questions. What are some of these bad attitudes, and how can we begin to avoid them?
Sure. In the book, I talk about bad attitudes on both sides, both people who believe in God or theists and those who don't believe in God or believe God does not exist, which would be atheists. And I really want to encourage people to have these dialogues, but to just, yeah, don't bring the bad attitudes in that torpedo the conversation right off the bat. For example, for theists, for believers, for theists, when they have bad attitudes, usually it takes the form of really denigrating atheists, saying that atheists are stupid because they don't believe in God. I mean, it's so obvious they must be stupid, or atheists are just atheists because they're immoral. And if they're an atheist, they have no reason to be moral because they don't believe in God. And that just really doesn't understand where atheists come from. I have met atheists who haven't really put much thought into whether God exists or not. I believe they're actually called ap-atheists, which is a portmanteau for apathy and atheist. But many atheists I meet are very intelligent, very bright, have looked through these arguments rigorously, haven't been convinced by it. And I think that's okay. People can have disagreements, rational disagreements over these arguments. But I think theists should say no. Many atheists are very intelligent people, and they just want evidence presented to them in a charitable way, and we should try to do that. And it's just, you're not crazy or irrational if you don't believe in God. So I think we should just approach each other without verbal attacks. That also goes for the morality issue. When people say, oh, well, you're just like Hitler, or the Nazis were atheists, which isn't factually true, but I say in the book, saying somebody's like Hitler starts the conversation off on the wrong foot. I mean, I've seen in debates when theists and atheists just throw the Nazi card out there without really thinking it through. People don't even want to listen to the argument, even if it is valid. Because sometimes comparison with Nazis are valid. But as soon as people hear it, they just shut down. So I think it's important for theists to know atheists can follow personal and cultural codes of morality. They are more than capable of doing that. The question is, can you have objective morality if atheism is true? That's the main question we should follow. So those are some of the bad attitudes on the theistic side. On the atheistic side, I think the bad attitudes are atheists being very dismissive of theists and just saying that they're stupid or unscientific and that religion contradicts science, so obviously God doesn't exist. Well, that's just not true. There are many religions that foster harmony between science and religion. And even more so, that's not the main question. So we shouldn't just be dismissive. They should know there are very powerful arguments for the existence of God people have wrestled with, and atheists shouldn't just dismiss them out of hand. Nor should they try to dismiss religion by saying, oh, well, if you were born in Iran, you'd be a Muslim. But you're born in America, so you're a Christian. If you were born in China, you'd be a Buddhist, or Japan, or wherever. That doesn't really prove anything. All that proves is that large numbers of people could be wrong. I mean, if I was born in North Korea, I'd probably believe in a dictatorship. And if I was born here in America, I believe in a democracy. That doesn't show there's no rational difference between democracy and dictatorship, just because lots of people could be wrong because of where they're born. So I think that we need to just move aside these side issues, dealing with people's character or the histories of thought systems, and look at the arguments and the evidence and see what do they point towards, theism or atheism.
Now, in your book, you spend a considerable amount of space engaging the cosmological arguments for God. So things like the Kalam argument, the argument from first cause and contingency, these have traditionally been some of the most powerful arguments for God throughout history. But many atheists like to aim their sights at refuting these particular arguments. In your experiences dialoguing with atheists, what are some of the most common misunderstandings you see regarding the cosmological arguments?
Yeah, I think the most common misunderstanding of the cosmological argument that I've seen is a poor formulation of the argument. Usually it's when you formulate the argument like this. If everything needs a cause, the universe exists, or the universe is a thing, therefore the universe has a cause. Which the atheist rejoins, ah, yes, but if everything needs a cause, then what caused God? Well, if God doesn't need a cause, maybe the universe doesn't need a cause. I mean, that's verbatim how Bertrand Russell argued in his book, Why I'm Not a Christian, Russell being one of the 20th century's most famous atheists. But the problem is that that's not the most adequate formulation of the cosmological argument. That what we should say is that whatever everything needs an explanation for its existence in its own nature or outside of its own nature. That would be the argument from contingency, which is its own argument. Or everything which begins to exist requires a cause. And so that doesn't apply to God because God never began to exist. So I think a big misunderstanding occurs when people don't formulate the argument correctly. I think the next thing that happens is that atheists will try to just grant the premises of the arguments and then kind of hand wave away the conclusion as being evidence for God. I've seen many atheists just kind of glibly say, well, so what if this argument works? Maybe it shows that the universe was created by a cosmic toaster. And I don't. So the argument's silly. It couldn't prove God, so I'm not going to try to refute it. But if we look at the argument more carefully of what the conclusions show, such as the Kalam argument, it shows that if all of reality, all the universe, which is all of space, time, matter, and energy, came into existence, then the cause of the universe could not be constituted of matter or energy, because then it would be the case that matter and energy created matter and energy. And so you have a contradiction there. Rather, the cause must be some kind of being or force that is not made of matter or energy or space or time. And then you would talk about whether this cause is impersonal or a force or personal and is a being, which is a valid discussion to have. So I think when it comes to these arguments that I understand that the premises can seem simple. And so an atheist may think, oh, how could this simple argument prove the existence of God? I'm not even going to pay attention to it. Well, the premises may be simple, but there are very complex ideas behind them people wrestle and debate with that can't be dismissed so easily, and we have to continue that debate and discussion. We can't just glibly say, oh, these arguments have been refuted, because I really believe they're still live and in play, and we have to continue the dialogue.
Now, you also spend much time in the book engaging strong arguments for atheism. In fact, you engage no less than 5 major arguments for atheism. As a Catholic, what would you say is the most formidable argument for atheism, and then how would you respond to it?
Yeah, I think the most formidable argument for atheism, or the view that God does not exist, would be what is called the problem of evil and suffering. The reason that I think this argument is so formidable is that, unlike other arguments which try to show there's no evidence for God, well, at best, those arguments would only justify agnosticism or the view that we can't know if God exists. If the problem of evil and suffering is successful as an argument, it would show there is no God, because a loving, all-powerful, all-knowing God would be contradicted by the fact that there's evil and suffering, which in theory shouldn't exist if he exists. And so I think that the argument has some force behind it, especially emotional force, that people just look around the world, they see all these terrible things that happen, and they think to themselves, well, if I had all of God's powers, I would snap my fingers and make everything so much better. Why doesn't God do that? Maybe the best explanation is that God doesn't exist. That's why evil is still around, because if I were God, I'd fix it. So I think it's emotionally powerful. But I think that logically the argument doesn't succeed. And the way I approach the argument is an approach that I like, that the fellow Christian apologist William Lane Craig, his approach. He divides the argument into 3 sub-arguments. First would be the logical problem of evil, the idea that God and evil logically contradict each other. If God exists, there can be no evil whatsoever. And I show in the book that, well, no, I don't think there's a logical contradiction, because God allowing evil to exist can allow certain goods to exist, and that can give God good reasons to allow evil, such as creatures having free will to choose to do goods that wouldn't be possible if God controlled all of our actions. Then the next argument, though, that comes up is the evidential problem of evil. People, atheists, sometimes say, well, okay, maybe evil and God could coexist, but there's so much evil in the world that seems utterly pointless. Odds are there is no God. And it's at that point I'm going to ask the atheist to justify his burden of proof in showing that all the evils we see are pointless and that God could have no good reason for allowing them. And I would propose maybe a few possible good reasons and then show we're not in a good position to know if God has good reasons for allowing evil. And also there's other facts which we have to import into our assessment of the case, which can change its outcome, such as if God can remedy all evil at the end of time, or if there's other arguments for God that counterbalance the doubt created by evil. And then finally, I may ask an atheist to tell me what evil is. Sometimes people say, well, it's the problem of evil and suffering. But if evil is just a bunch of bad stuff we really dislike that causes us pain, that's kind of the same definition of suffering. So it makes evil and suffering redundant. Rather, I think that evil is just a state of affairs that shouldn't be. Evil occurs when things aren't the way they're supposed to be. And sometimes the way things aren't supposed to be is that there's unjust suffering, pain for what seems like not a right reason. But here's the thing, though. If evil is basically the way things are not supposed to be, then it follows that good involves the way things are supposed to be, where there's some kind of design or end for the universe. So if evil is the contradiction of the great cosmic plan, well, then there's a great cosmic plan. And so evil, at least moral evil in particular, provides kind of indirect evidence for God. So that's kind of how I approach it in the book. And I encourage theists not to give pat answers to the problem of evil. I mean, this answer I've given you, it's not going to console somebody whose grandmother has dementia and is dying. So I think there's a lot more to endure evil. And that evil isn't something that we can just – the problem of evil isn't something we refute. It's something we have to endure. But while we endure it, I think we have good reasons that show we shouldn't just rush to atheism, that those good reasons to believe in God and show the problem of evil doesn't succeed, they're like the floaties we hang on to in the swimming pool. We still have to kick and do our effort, but those good reasons help us stay afloat, and then we have to do the effort to endure what evil does to us and trust in God to guide us through that. At least that'd be my perspective.
Now, you close the book with a small section on the value of personal religious experience in showing the evidence for God. What value do these subjective experiences have? What legitimacy do they have for people hoping to make a case for God?
Sure. I don't necessarily argue that because I have an experience of God, that proves God exists and you should believe in God. What I will say, though, is I think it's totally valid for someone to believe God exists, at least for them to subjectively believe that, because they've had an experience of God. And this is a conclusion that the philosopher Alvin Plantinga arrived at in his trilogy on Warrant. He wrote the books like Warrant and Proper Function and Warrant, I think it's called Warrant and Christian Faith or Warrant and Christianity, the book he wrote in the year 2000, his end of the trilogy. Basically, it goes like this, that if God exists, if he exists, then God is capable of revealing himself to people internally. He can make people internally aware of his existence. So if someone has a belief in God, I think that belief is justified if God exists. So if God is real, someone has a personal experience of God, I think that's a valid way to know God. I mean, it's not a good reason to share with an atheist that God exists because they don't have access to your experience. They can't examine it and see what it's like for themselves. It's good subjective evidence. But for objective evidence, you'd have to use the other kind of arguments that I present in my book. But I don't think there's anything wrong with believing something based on subjective evidence. For example, Plantinga uses the case of you being falsely accused of a crime you didn't commit. The objective evidence may convince a jury, but subjectively, you might still think you're innocent. And so I still think that in the absence of a strong defeater to your belief in your innocence, then you're justified in believing you didn't commit the crime, even if the objective evidence seems to point in that direction. So I think that if someone personally believes in God, that can be a good reason for them. And I don't see why they should give it up in the absence of a strong defeater. But if they want to share God with other people, I think their personal testimony is helpful, but they'll want to augment it with some objective reasons. And I provide that in my book.
Well, thanks again, Trent, for taking the time to chat. I encourage all viewers, Catholics and atheists alike, to check out Trent's new book, Answering Atheism, How to Make the Case for God with Logic and Charity. Before we go here, Trent, where can people go online to find out more about your writing, your speaking, and the new book?
Well, I would say that you can go to my website, trenthorn.com, or you can go to the website of the organization I work with, Catholic Answers, which is catholic.com. The book will be available at a website called answeringatheism.com, or you can order the book directly, which would probably be the easiest source. To get a copy, you can go to answeringatheism.com or to catholic.com, go to our shop and search for it there. And I think the book will help a lot of Catholics to really understand atheism and the arguments for and against it, understand that. And even for atheists who even might be weary of the debate over the existence of God, I think they may find the book interesting, that I've tried to understand their position. And at the very least, I think they can appreciate it that if a theist reads the book, they'll be much more up to speed. They'll get past a lot of misconceptions, and theists and atheists, upon reading this, could have a richer dialogue about where they disagree. And I think Catholics will be better equipped to reach out to friends and family who are not religious, who don't believe in God, and try to share these good reasons with them and keep the dialogue going.
Excellent. And for more interviews, articles, and rich comment box discussion, be sure to check out strangenotions.com. Thanks for tuning in.